Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, I'm sitting here at the Broken Skull Ranch. I'm sitting there talking to Mark Eaton, former WWE referee, timekeeper, and beer thrower extraordinaire, the man who's probably launched to me at least a couple thousand beers and was responsible for several buzzes that I walked away from the ring from. Anyway, long-time guy in a WWE / WWF, Mark Eaton. Mark, how are you?
I'm doing good, Stone Cold. Good to hear from you.
Man, what are you up to these days?
I just got a local job now, staying at home, taking care of my farm. I'm just out taking care of the horses right now, just a little bit ago.
I know. I've been trying to get a hold of you. You sound like you're real busy. Where do you live? Are you in Pennsylvania?
Yes, sir. Down in Pennsylvania, or up in Pennsylvania from you. But yeah, winter's finally starting to set in, so I got to watch out for the geese and ducks and the horse with the snow coming soon.
It's starting to get cold up there. Tell me about the farm. How many acres you got out there? What all you got?
I get just over 50 acres. We get a... You don't have very many animals. Just have a horse, a pony, some chickens, ducks, and geese. And, of course, cats and dogs like everybody.
Hey, man, have you always had that farm, or were you in the city when you was on the road with WWF?
I've been here for a little over 21 years. So, yeah, when I got married, moved to Pennsylvania, and then this is my second home in Pennsylvania.
Hey, man, let's talk a little bit about the business of professional wrestling. I guess you started with WWE, then WWF, what, 84, 85?
I started with WWF back in 1984, yes.
Okay, man, let me ask you, did you grow up a wrestling fan? What in the world possessed you to say, hey, man, I want to get in the pro wrestling business?
No, I wasn't didn't follow wrestling when I was growing up. My friend started working for the company, and he asked me to come help him set a ring up one day in an armory in Fall River, Mass. And I set the ring up there, and I've been there ever since, or was there ever since, until a couple of years ago.
Well, what was your job first starting out? Because, you know, obviously you were a timekeeper. We can get that to a little bit. But how did you start? Was it a ring crew?
Yeah, I was just a laborer, just setting the ring up from town to town, doing that. I started refereeing in 1985 in Lake Placid, New York. One of the referees didn't show up, and the agent chief, Jay Strongbow, said, hey, you want to referee? He threw me in the ring, and I refereed for 12 years after that.
Well, what did you think when you refereed your first match? Had you been hanging around the boys long, or the guys that were reffing long enough to kind of get a sense of it, or just go in there green as grass and go for it?
Well, I started in May of 84. I was there almost a year before I started, so I knew a lot of the guys, and it was very scary. My adrenaline was very pumped. When I came back after getting thrown out of the ring by Cowboy Bob Orton, so you are right back there, and I said, yeah, I'm fine. But I guess my adrenaline was pumping because the next morning when I woke up, it was hard to move. I was sore.
How long did it take you to pick up your chops and learn the rules and just learn to stay out of the way of the guys?
Oh, man. It was very, very heavy kayfabe when I started. When I started as a ring crew, I wasn't even allowed to walk in the locker room. When I had to go in, all of a sudden, everybody stopped talking immediately. And it took them a while to know me so I could know them and get to know more of the business. But like I said, after I started refereeing about a year later, everything started to come smoothly after that.
Did any other referees, because you were the longest tenured referee for a good while. I mean, Kyoto's been there since about 89. You were there since 84, started reffing in 85. Who was a guy that maybe took you under his wing and helped you out? Like some of the veterans, you know, as far as the ring work goes, you know, take a guy under his wing and help him out. Who were the referees, or did anybody help you out and learn the trade?
The referees, Dave Hebner taught me a lot about refereeing. He took me under, and I worked a lot with him on a lot of house shows back in the day. We were doing a lot of shows every week, and I was working a lot of shows with just him, and he taught me most of the ropes on that.
And he was awesome, as was Earl. When did Earl come into the fold?
Oh, that was quite a few years later. I honestly don't remember, but it was a few years down the road.
Hey, talk about those kayfabe days for a second, how everything was heavy kayfabe back then. And yeah, I mean, just from an insider perspective, you were a company employee setting up the ring, transitioning to a referee, but the boys would shut up when you walked into a room. Was that shocking to you? Did it just take them a while to accept you? What do you think about the way kayfabe has transitioned and almost non-existent today?
That's a different world today. Now that we have all the internet and everything, you can't do as much as you could back then. But they kept everything very tight-lipped, and it was much better for the fan. You know, the fan didn't know anything that was going to happen. It was just it was always a surprise and always a shock, and kept them going.
Tell me about the travel back in the days, Mark, for a referee. Obviously, I know what it was for us boys. We'd get a bunch of us in a car and go down the road. What about the refs? How'd you guys travel?
Pretty much the same way. When I was ring crewing and refereeing, I was driving a ring truck. But if I was just out on the road refereeing, I'd usually be hooking up with, like, Jack Lanza, Tony Gurria, Dave Hebner, and we'd get four of us in a car and same type of thing. You know, just save where you could.
What about the headaches and hassles of being on the road with that ring truck? Because, I mean, the company's depending on you to get that ring to the show to set it up so the boys could work and so that everybody could make some money. Any catastrophic breakdowns or accidents?
There's a few incidents. One time, way back, my buddy pulled over the side of the road to relieve himself, not realizing that there wasn't a shoulder there because the snow was covering it, and the ring truck sort of like slid down the embankment. And when they brought the tow truck in to tow it out, the ring truck brought their tow truck to it. So they had to bring in one of the really big rigs to pull us out of the mud. But we made it to show on time, not a problem. And another time, I was driving with Tony Chimmel coming through Texas, and he had a blowout. And we went across like five lanes of highway, and God willing, everybody was good. I mean, nothing happened. The truck didn't flip. No accidents involved, just a blown out tire. We ended up on the side of the road. We had to wait for that to get fixed, but luckily we were after the show heading home. But at the one time it was really close, we were doing a show in Minot, North Dakota, and they weren't sure if the ring was going to get there. So they actually put two rings in. Both rings made it, and they ended up canceling the show because of snow.
One time I was working for WCW, we were out in Phoenix, and the ring made it, but they sent the wrong ropes, so we didn't have any ropes, so they canceled the show, and it just to a case of, you know, sending the wrong ropes. So there's a case where you guys got two rings, but there's snow, so you got plenty of rings to work with, but the show's canceled nonetheless.
Yeah.
Mark, you've thrown me a couple thousand beers. Now, out on the road, and as long as I've known you, we've never really hung around in private too much because we were always shooting a breeze at work, and I was catching the beers you were throwing. Were you a drinker? Were you a partier? Because I knew you'd kind of be just a straight-laced guy.
Yeah, I didn't drink too much. You know, I'd have one or two every once in a while, but no, it was pretty much steady on the road. I was working 6-7 days a week. I was working 30 days a month. I was doing a different show every day. So I didn't have any time to do that. As soon as I finished the show, I'd have to break down the ring, put it in the truck, and then get to the next town. And then, you know, catch a couple hours sleep before I could set it up, then go work out, and then, you know, get back there, do the show, break down, put it in the truck, get to the next town. So it was a continuous movement. I didn't really have much time to go out and party.
You get a lot of guys in the ring that finally they'll just break down. It's just too much. It's just, you know, they'll get overloaded. They'll get burned out. Did the grind ever get to you, Mark? Because like you said, you're talking about a 30-day stretch, and that was when the business was, you know, at a pretty hot period and you guys were slamming it. So did you ever get burned out and think, hey, man, what am I doing? Or was it all just you loved it so much it was fun to do and it was work?
Yeah, I don't remember having a meltdown. It was always fun. It was always something different. It was always something exciting happening. I always looked forward to it, make sure everything was always perfect and ready to go. And just always, you know, knowing you had to be there, just it kept me going. It, you know, I never had the time to think about breaking down because I just always had to go, make sure everything was there and ready to go for everybody.
Did you like going overseas or did you prefer to work in the States?
That's a tough one. When we did Kuwait, we did the Kuwaiti Cup. That was awesome. We went in, we built the ring once, and then we stayed there for a week. So it was like all I had to do was loosen the ropes at the end of the day and then go back in and tighten them up in the morning and make sure everything was all set. So those kind of days were great. I loved doing the India tour when I went. We were there 7 days. We worked 6 days. But on that seventh day, they actually got us a bus, and we went out and saw Taj Mahal and get to see a lot of a lot of the world. So I get to do a lot of I can't say sightseeing, but I did get to see a lot of the world on this job. It was quite an experience.
Hey, here's one for you, Mark. When I first went to WWF back in the day, man, the rings were pretty brutal. And I had heard that was from the previous generation of all the big guys, Hogan, Andre. They didn't want that ring moving around like a trampoline, so they really built some tough-ass rings, and they weren't very favorable for bumping. They weren't bump-friendly rings. And then finally, they kind of, I guess they reinvented it and turned it into a ring that you could bump in a lot better. Because when you first roll in there, it's kind of a come-to-Jesus moment for you coming out of the WCW rings, those 18-footers. So how did the rings change? How did they make them a little bit more user-friendly?
Oh, man, when we first started, they wanted it to be a traveling thing because we were on the road every day. So they had to make it easy to transport, and they wanted to fly under the radar a little bit. So we were in small trucks, so we didn't have to pull into weigh stations and so on, so it wasn't tied up there and here and there. So he made a ring with a spring in the center, which, of course, the fans all thought, hey, that makes it better. The spring in the center was a lot worse because that can bottom out, and that's what made it tough. It was made into quadrants, and we used plywood across steel beams. And so it's, like I said, it could bottom out that way. Once they found the ring in Alaska and saw how that was made with straight planks, where it has the natural spring of the board, no bottoming out that way, they started making them that way. You had to get it. Unfortunately, went from a 14-foot truck to a 24-foot truck. And then we had to get special licenses, had to pull into weigh stations and so on. But it made it a lot made a lot better for the boys. They had a lot more longevity. They could, their knees didn't give out as quick and so on and so forth.
Man, I'm telling you what, you'd think that there'd be some technology in making a ring. How did it come to be that they found a ring in Alaska that they would end up liking and model their rings after?
I don't know how it came. I don't know how it got up there. I'm not sure if it was Vince's ring that was up there first, or if it was a territorial ring that he had purchased when he was buying out everybody. But I did a couple of shows up there, and when the boys bumped in that ring, they were like, this is like heaven. They loved it. So they kept bringing it up to Vince, and he said, oh, let's see what we can do. They brought that ring back from Alaska and designed after that, and that's the kind of ring they're still using today.
And, you know, people think, you know, when they saw the shock absorber, the spring underneath the middle of some of those rings, they think, oh, man, that thing's like a trampoline. Let me tell you something. Just like Mark just said, man, when the boys are taking bumps and you land on your back for a living, you know when you're in a good ring, a bad ring, or sometimes, Mark, you remember those planks would jump up and turn cattywampus, or there'd be a hole in a ring and guys would blow out their knees. Give the basic construction of those old rings, because I always tell people, and you can tell me if I'm wrong or right, from what I remember seeing you guys set them up as many times as I did, it was a 20 by 20 squared circle, steel frame, 2 by 12s laid across it, a felt mat laid across that, and then the canvas, and basically y'all tied that down and tightened the ropes. Is that correct, or can you tighten me up on that?
The ring that I started with consisted of a steel frame with a spring in the center, making it into four quadrants. Each quadrant got 5 to 6 beams. We started with 5, and they ended up putting in 6 cross, like metal 2x4s. And going to the center plate was we used 4x10 sheets of plywood. We had 10 4x sheets of plywood that went in there. And those sometimes could crack or jump up on each other and put a nice thing, a nice edge on it. On top of that, we had 1.5 inches of foam padding, like a rug padding and stuff. And then on top of that was the canvas. But now the new ring is more like you said, where it's just the frame, big square, and then it's got some cross members going both directions, upper and lower. And then it has the 20-foot planks that go all the way across that stretch all the way. No spring in the center.
Hey, man, how many years did you last in the ring refereeing?
I was 12 years I refereed.
Okay, 12 years as a referee, getting up and down, on your knees, making counts, sometimes being involved in the match physically. Someone may lay a hand on you. You may end up taking someone's finish. So after 12 years of refereeing in the business of professional wrestling, how does your body feel?
I feel it every morning when I get up. Yeah, it's a... I'm sure I don't take it as bad as the wrestlers. You guys only had one match, but you did a lot more bumping than I did. I was in there like 3 or 4 matches a night, but I didn't take the bumps that you guys took. So I can just imagine what you guys have gone through. I mean, I refereed a match one time up in Toronto with Monday Night Raw for a guy named Steve Austin going against Vader. I got in Steve's way, and he pushed me out and gave me a stunner. I had to get out of that way for that one. But I'll tell you, the worst bump I took was the one that hurt the worst, the one that felt the most was when Ken Shamrock gave me a belly-to-belly on an old-style ring. That just knocked the wind right out of me. I couldn't move. But, yeah, my body still aches still.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
Hey, man, do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. And I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com. Did you ever get injured? I mean, seriously injured. Did you ever blow out a vertebrae, a knee, high your shoulders from counting?
My right shoulder's still a little messed up. It's never gone out, but it's messed up a little bit. The worst thing, I get bruised ribs one time when I got kicked in the chest. Triple H broke my head open with a bell one time. I got a couple black eyes from that one. But those are probably about the worst I ever got. I was really lucky.
How did you guys feel across the board knowing that you're going to be involved in the physicality of the match? You know, be it a ref or be it a ref bump or, you know, taking someone's finish or, you know, tossed out of the ring?
To me, it was more exciting. It was I got to be more part of it. I don't know how to explain it. It's just you want to be a part of it, but being able to help out a match, it just you get a little satisfaction out of being able to help out.
Hey, what about the let's shift gears a second, just as far as just timing and like tag team matches and stuff like that, just being pulled by the opposition, head turned at the right time. Did you ever get mad at the boys when the heat went to the referee instead of to them because of the way they were drawing or misdrawing you?
Not really. I guess I might have, but I just they were always bigger than me, so I wouldn't say anything. But no, I mean, there was a couple times where the bad guys won in L.A., and literally the Samoans had to get me out of the ring under their protection because I was getting stuff thrown at me, or trying to hit me. The fans were just trying to kill me because the bad guys cheated and won, and I didn't see it. But things like that, it's fun. It got a little crazy back in those days. I mean, Boston Garden, Nassau Coliseum, I was seeing D-sized batteries flying into the ring, heads of cabbage coming flying at us. I had a bottle break next to my head in Boston Garden. There were some crazy fans back in the early days.
Well, was it their crazy fans or was because the business was still kayfabe and the heels could get more heat?
Exactly, yeah. They were crazy fans because it's all real to them. And it really was because as far as they knew no one was going out there and saying what they say today. So the bad guys were bad guys, and the fans knew them as bad guys, and that's how they personified, and that's how they lived in and out of the ring. I mean, it was years before I knew a lot of the wrestlers' real names. I only knew them by their character name, and I worked with them, and I still didn't know their real names. And because they lived it inside and outside the ring. I mean, they carried the persona with them. So if they saw fans in a restaurant, even though you're a bad guy, not like today where they're giving autographs and taking pictures, they were a bad guy in a restaurant. And they lived it.
Well, yeah, things have changed a little bit. Did you, you're kind of, as being a guy that worked in a ring, as a, you know, Stone Cold or Stunning Steve or whatever, I always had my favorite towns. As a referee, did you have a favorite town or favorite region that did you like to frequent? You know, I like being in the South. I like being in the Northeast periodically. Population density was good for houses, but those tollways took a toll on me, no pun intended, because, you know, I'd either miss the bucket throwing the quarters in or I'd miss my exit, and those cement girders meant you couldn't do a U-turn for 30 miles. On the West Coast, yeah, it's a little bit of a cluster. So my question is to you, did you have a favorite part of the United States you like to work in?
I always like to travel. I like to see the scenery and so on with the drives. But when it came to working, I liked working in the New England area. I mean, from Maine down to Connecticut, New York a little bit. Boston was always my favorite town. It might have been because of my hometown, but the fans were always good there. They were always very loud, very into it. You just felt the energy in the air when you were there. And I just liked working those.
Any favorite memories from Madison Square Garden, just because that's in the Northeast and because, I mean, that was probably my second favorite building to work as far as crowd, because Chicago was the Rosemount was my favorite building. But the Garden was special because, you know, from a performer standpoint, some of the best, just from all walks of entertainment, performed there. How was the Garden to you? Because that was a show where Vince would always show up. And, man, if Vince was there, you knew it was a big deal. It might just be a regular card, but the fact that the old man was there meant that everybody was going to step it up. And you stepped it up anyway because it was the Garden. Any favorite memories from the Garden or just thoughts on the Garden itself?
Not really. It was every time, like you said, when you go there, it was always something big. But like I said, I didn't grow up a wrestling fan. And after I got the job, when I realized I was into something, was the first time I did Madison Square Garden. And they announced a guy named Hulk Hogan. And the hair on my arm stood up, and I just felt the energy in that building explode. And I said, okay, I'm into something big here. It was crazy. I had never felt anything like that in my life.
What year was that, Mark?
That had to have been late 84.
Oh, shoot. So then when was the first WrestleMania? Because you've been a part of 29. You worked 27 of them.
WrestleMania 1 was 1985.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just before that. There was the Rock and Wrestling Connection time.
That was such a great period.
Yeah, I didn't work WrestleMania 1 because I was a newbie still, basically. And the boss got mad at me for WrestleMania 6, so he didn't bring me up to Canada for the first one up there in 6. But between the other ones, between 1 and 30, I worked every one of them.
But what about WrestleMania 2 when you're involved with that melee between Roddy Piper and Mr. T? I mean, man, you were a youngster. How serious was that?
That was quite an adrenaline rush. Actually getting into the ring at WrestleMania, the first of three legs of WrestleMania, so it was just the start of the show, and to work with Roddy Piper and Mr. T and the other people that were there, it was just a whole bunch with that melee. And it was a feeling that just a rush through your body. You know, the people give you the energy. It was crazy.
Hey, tell me about that period right then when Hulkamania was taken off, and you guys knew where you were in for a big ride, right?
Oh, yeah. You could feel that with the people everywhere you went. I mean, we were doing two or three shows a day sometimes. We were doing double shots. I'd do a show. One time I did a show in the afternoon or the morning, I guess, matinee, and last match, and I jumped on a little plane with myself, Hulk Hogan, and Brutus Beefcake, and we flew to the next town and did another show. It was just crazy. And they were all sold out. There were just people packed everywhere. Everywhere we went, there was just, like I said, the houses were just crazy. They were always packed. And Hulk was the biggest thing going right then. God, when I started, there was only a couple of theme musics when I started working there. And he was coming out to Eye of the Tiger, I think, at the time. So a lot of stuff has changed over the years, but I don't know how to explain his era. It was surreal.
It was interesting for me to watch it because I was such a fan, and I was growing up mainly, you know, on world-class stuff, Houston Wrestling, NWA, Mid-South Power Pro, and then I finally started getting WWF, and it was kind of a different animal. But, I mean, you could see, you know, everything was on fire. The Rock and Wrestling thing was phenomenal. The crowds were going crazy. You know, the business was still, you know, pretty kayfabe. And, you know, people were buying in hook, line, and sinker. And so it was hot. My question is, you know, the boys always get paid on the house. You know, if there's a lot of people there, you're going to make pretty good money, depending on where you are on the card. If there ain't nobody there, ain't nobody going to make no money because ain't no money to carve up. How did they pay you guys? Was it per match, or were you guys based on the house too?
that changed with the days. We didn't get paid very well for refereeing at the beginning there, and basically Dave would call and talk to people at the office, say, wait a second, we just went out there and busted our butt for 9 matches and you're going to give us this? And it changed that way there. I think how we get paid was how the agent felt that day. It was not a set amount. And then they started to get into set amounts and started giving us more and more. And then they started doing a set amount, but it was proportional to the show. So if the show did really good, our amount did go up. So it was basically a percentage type deal.
So what were you thinking when you weren't making a whole lot of money? I mean, did you ever think, hey, man, I'm on the road 30 days a month here. They ain't paying me squat. Maybe I ought to find something else to do.
That's where I had an advantage over the other wrestlers and referees, is because they had me on a paycheck. I was getting a paycheck every week for being a ring crew. So I started driving the truck, so I had my own transportation paid for. They were paying for my hotel because I had to get the ring there. And I was getting paid for doing my job. So on top of that, refereeing was a bonus to me. So it was a little bit different. Yes, it was a little bit different than you guys.
Hey, what was the transition for you to turn into the timekeeper?
George Skolin was doing it. We were doing TV every third Tuesday in Poughkeepsie, New York. And I'm not sure how or why it came about, but they wanted to put me out there. They put me out there, and Kevin Dunn really liked the way I did the job, because when I started timekeeping, there were no IFBs. I was the sole communication from the executive producer and Vince to the wrestlers or the referees in the ring. So it was all in my hand signals, my bodily gestures or whatever, to signal to them what was going on for a TV show. And they liked the way I did it, so I did it a couple times, and they just kept me in that position.
So I'm imagining these signals, as you say, would be akin to, like, in a baseball game, the manager sending signs to the batter.
Yeah. The difference would be with mine was I'd have to give them countdowns for commercials, have to tell them when we're in commercial break, countdowns to when we're coming back from commercial. But yeah, it was the same type of thing. It was just a different signal here and there. So I'm not being a producer in front of all the fans saying, hey, guys, we got 10 seconds before we come back. So I get a kayfabe from the fans, too. When George Skolin was telling him, hey, time to go home, take his glasses off. And then the boys know, okay, we're at time. We got to go. And, you know, then with me, the beginning was a pencil in the mouth, which ended up not being too much kayfabe because it was all over the internet. People could finally start seeing it, but that was the final signal. But given the countdowns and the how many minutes were in and how many minutes were to go and so on, it was and of course, if Vince wanted to change something, I would have to get to them and get them off camera and tell the referee and slip something to whoever. So we tried to do that very discreetly, and I guess I must have done a pretty decent job. I did it for over 25 years.
With the advent of IFBs being the little microphones that the guys can wear in their ears now, and you're doing it manually, how do you do a 10-second countdown going to commercial break?
That was the easy part. 10 seconds is just 10 fingers.
Ah, so you just go ahead and use the fingers.
Yep, I just do the fingers and just keep them as subtle as I could on my chest or whatever, so it's not like holding them up over my head. You know, just hold them to my chest or whatever, so it's close. Make sure that I had to make sure the referee saw them. So I had to get his attention, so they'd keep looking over when they could, get their attention and let him know, okay, well, this was a 10 seconds. Now you're down to 4 before you finally saw me. You only got 4 seconds to go. You know, so sometimes it happened like that, so...
So what would you do when no one had your attention or you couldn't get their attention and the countdown was on? Did you start to panic? You say, hey, man, we got to go home.
I'd find a way to get up there and get the attention of him somehow. Or Mr. Jack Lonzo would walk down the entranceway and flip his tie.
That's a real good one, because Jack Lanza took me under his wing. And when I talk about veterans taking you under wing, he really helped me out when I came to the WWF way back in 95. And to hear him go out there and say, you know, flip his tie, I mean, that's almost like a house show type of thing, because when Grizzly Smith used to run the house shows in WCW, you know, when it was time for the boys to go home, he'd saunter out there and make a lap around the ring, just walking. You know, Grizz was about 6'9", he'd just kind of casually flip his tie and walk back. So no one didn't think anything of it. They just thought it was a senior member or someone from the company going out there and sauntering around the ring. But if the guys didn't go home because they're having a damn good match, or maybe they're stinking the joint out but were just so involved in it, he'd go out there again, and he'd start flipping his tie. When he flipped it a second time, if you didn't go home, you'd either get fined or get your ass chewed out.
There's always a time when the executive producer on the headset says, just ring the bell. They try not to do that. They can because they got to make sure the camera shot's at the right spot. But if they went way over, there was – I can't remember which – I wish I could remember what it was. But there was actually one match we had on Monday Night Raw that didn't make air. The finish did not make air.
Oh,
because
my.
The boys didn't get their signals, and they just kept going.
So who takes the heat on that?
That time there was the talent. The talent just wanted to get their high spots in, and they wanted to keep going. So it all depends upon whose fault it was, why it didn't happen. Did they not get their signals? Did they not get this? And of course, it's always the blame game. Hey, I told you. You looked at me, and I said, no, you never told me. Whatever. So you never know. Depends upon who the agent was, what was going on at the time.
So you're not actually physically keeping time. You're taking cues and relaying them.
I had bell-to-bell time.
Okay.
In the truck, Kevin keeps segment time. So they know exactly what started at certain times. When I rang that bell, I hit a stopwatch. And when I rang the bell to end the match, I hit the stopwatch again. So I actually had bell-to-bell actual times, and I kept that time, and I marked it on every sheet. I still have a lot of the sheets that from back in the day, the lineups. With the actual times of the matches on them.
Hey, here's a question for you, or a little story, and then a question. I worked, it's been so long, it was years ago, I worked a Monday Night Raw match with Chris Benoit. We had a certain amount of time, and it wasn't enough to really get a story across, and so I wasn't very happy with the match, and the next night, or whatever it was, they booked us, I think it was Edmonton, and it was on SmackDown, and it was live to tape, or just going to post. So I told Chris, I said, hey, man, we didn't get enough time on the first match. I said, just follow me here. I said, when I say go home, we'll go home. And I told him, I said, I'll take the heat if anybody gets mad. So basically, well, you know, they probably gave us 12 to 14 minutes. I think the match ended up being close to 24. But it was a damn good match. But my question to you is, what happens in an in-your-ear type of thing if you're keeping time, you're ringing a bell, you've got Stone Cold Steve Austin who has a little bit of stroke and he ain't going home, and so you guys got to weather the storm. On one hand, the fans got a great match. But what's happening in your ears is I'm taking too much time.
You're talking about what match they're going to scratch. Someone else is coming off the card. Which match they're not going to air that night. One of the girls' matches? Well, they're not wrestling tonight. You know, they're off the card now. Sorry, we don't have the time. If it's a good match like that and they want it out there and they want the fans to see it, they will cut somebody else's match to give you that time. So that's what they're doing, is they're figuring out, okay, with this scrambling of what they're going to do and rearrange and say, okay, we're going to change the segment to this, we're going to add time here, and they're going to take some time there, and they're going to recalculate the whole show. So that's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing all those people going over with different numbers and trying to recalculate.
Man, you know, when you said, the girls' matches, because maybe back in those days they weren't considered as important as they are today, there's really been a movement within women's wrestling. And it's, man, the women these days are kicking ass.
Yes.
Do you still watch the show? Have you been able to watch some of the women, like Charlotte, Sasha, Bailey, Becky, those young ladies?
I actually haven't seen a show since I left. I don't follow it. So, no, I haven't seen that. I have a lot of friends that follow it, and they mention them. I know the names because I have a store, Big Time Collectibles, where I sell action figures, so I always have the new figures in stock. But, no, unfortunately, I have not seen any of the NXT players. I've heard a lot of good things about them, but I haven't seen any of them.
Do you still keep in contact with, like, a Jimmy Corderas or Timmy White or any of the guys, that, you know, like a Dave Hebner that used to be there back in the day?
I'm friends with a bunch of them on Facebook still, so we converse, send Christmas cards and stuff like that, happy birthdays. Everyone's so far apart, we don't see too much of each other. But yeah, Jimmy Corderas, I hear from him every once in a while. JBL, some of the talent, some of the referees. I'm still friends with a bunch of them, got their numbers. We, you know, like I said, happy holiday type deal.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
Hey man, do you own or rent your home? Sure you do, and I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com. So, Mark, you've been away from the business for, 2 years now?
Yes.
When I left the business, I had a hard time, me, making a transition because I wasn't ready to leave the business, and a bunch of injuries built up. And so it just took me a while to get away from it. When you got away from it, did you miss it? You still miss it? You at peace with yourself?
I'm at peace with myself, a lot less stress and so on and so forth like that. Get to be home with my wife and sleep in my own bed every night. It's a nice thing. I miss the traveling sometimes because I did get to see a lot of the world, which was really nice. And I have a lot of indie friends. I still referee indie shows. I work Pro Wrestling Empire, PWE, and some legacy shows and stuff in the Harrisburg area. So I still referee a little bit and try to help them out as much as I can with what I've learned over the years. So I have a little touch with it still. Like I said, I also still have the figures. I sell the figures and stuff. So I still have a little bit of connection, a little bit, just not with the company.
Where do you sell the figures at?
Saturday's Market in Middletown, PA. As Keeping Time Collectibles. I sell wrestling figures. I also sell like Star Wars, Star Trek, Walking Dead, so on and so forth like that. So yeah, I've had that going for about 8 years now. I've actually, a bunch of the wrestlers have come down and an autograph signing with me at the store, which is really good. A few of them have been there. Sheamus has been there. Rey Mysterio's been there. John Morrison's been there. Batista's been there. Kane's been there. A few of the guys came by. Like I said, I've had that a little over 8 years. So that's when I get to see the new talent. I see him in plastic figures.
Mark, with everything that you've seen and done in your almost 30 years with the WWF, WWE, what did you think when The Undertaker rolled in? Because, man, he had left WCW, and I'd been watching him before. I'd wrestled him down in USWA, and I think Mark had about a year and a half jump start on me in the business. And I always knew the guy was going to be a big star, but nobody just knew what to do with him. And, man, I was watching from Atlanta when he made his debut there in the WWF, and it was just flat-out scary. And he actually scared the kids in the crowd. When they would pan the arena, you could see that the kids actually had fear on their face because no one had ever seen anything like this guy before. When he came in and they dropped that Undertaker gimmick, what were your thoughts?
I'm with you. It was just scary. It was
scary.
It was amazing. Yeah, he played the part so well. I mean, he did not break kayfabe at all. When he walked through that curtain, he was the Undertaker, and you couldn't make him crack a smile. You're not going to make him get out of character anyway. And he played it right to the T. And like you said, he did. He put the fear in a lot of fans, and it worked very well for him. It was awesome.
Did you think it ever last as long as it did?
No, I never dreamed that a character like that would last that long. It's just amazing. Some that you do think are going to last, you know, what, last couple weeks, a couple of months, and they're gone. You say, wow, that would have been great. But then, you know, I never would have expected that to last as long as it did.
Hey, I just got an email from a guy who sent it to questions@steveaustinshow.com. That's my email address for my show. And this guy, just out of the blue, I think he's from Texas, says he wants to be a referee. And he's working at a store out here called Bucky's. And he just wants to quit his job and go be a referee. And so I sent him an email back and said, hey, man, before you do that, you might want to do some long-term thinking about, you know, saving some money, making a plan, learning how to referee, much less getting a job. What would you tell somebody, since you've had 30 years in the business, if they want to learn how to be a referee, what would you tell them?
Start on the indie shows. Start on the indie shows and get out there and try to referee and learn the rules and watch. Just watch the referees on the TV show. Just keep watching them, see what they do and their movements. The referee is a big part of a match. I mean, they're not in there wrestling, but if they're not there, it's nothing. You don't have the authority in the ring. It doesn't matter. But the authority has to be not someone sitting back in a corner watching the match. It's going to be somebody that's in there, but also out of the way. So there's a lot to learn being a referee. If he wants to do this, he should probably find a local. There's locals everywhere. There's local independent shows all over the country. He should get one in his area and try doing a couple matches and see what it's like. It's a lot more physical than you realize. A lot of people say, hey, that'll be fun. It looks easy. It's not as easy as you think.
Well, first of all, it ain't easy because I've refereed some high-profile matches, and I was happy to do them. But, man, as a professional wrestler, I know the rules to a degree, but not from an enforcement standpoint. So I can enforce the obvious, but man, there is certainly an art to it. And just because you wrestled for 10 to 13 years doesn't mean you know how to referee. I think Shawn Michaels has always done a good job in his referee roles. But, no, it's a lot harder than it looks. Just keeping up with the action, getting down for the counts, staying out of the way. Just with reversals and everything else, or being somewhere where you need to be to get taken out for a ref bump, timing, and just it is everything. There ain't nothing like having a great referee or having a real bad referee, because it's a big-ass difference.
Yeah, that's for sure. And like you were saying before about injuries, I forgot, I wasn't even thinking about it. I came up on the wrong side of Steve Yaffe one time. He was up in the corner. When he came back with a punch, I caught his elbow right in the nose, and I was bleeding all over the ring that night too. I was seeing stars. He came back with a punch and just got me with his elbow because I came up on the wrong side of him. So you're gonna need to, you have to know where you are in the ring at all times too, because these guys aren't fooling around in there.
From a work standpoint, guys being masterful or magician-like in the ring, or guys that you had a great chemistry with as far as working their matches, give me a couple of names.
Macho Man was always fun to work with. He requested me a few times because he liked that I was small, quick, and when he, you know, give me a flinch, I'd be gone. Get out of his way quick and get out of there. I liked doing stuff with Undertaker, same thing. You know, could you get to sell it a little bit more, you know? Because just the look will you know, you freeze. You know, he turns and looks at you, you freeze and get out of the way.
Yeah,
one time he scared me right out of the ring into Paul Bearer's arms in Kuwait. And, of course, he sees me in his arms, he throws me on the floor. But a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun back at the midget matches, so the little people matches back in the day, too, because we did a lot of fun with those, refereeing those matches. Wrestling was a lot different in the 80s than it is today. I think we had a lot more fun in the ring. Now it's more of a business.
I see where you're going there. It was always business, but it seemed like back in the day, because they were booking the territory, they let you fill in the blanks, and it seems like these days there's not as many blanks to fill in. They filled them in for you.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, it was always business. You always get there, and it was business, but it was like the boys enjoyed it in the ring. It wasn't like, okay, you went and do your job and you're done. And like you were saying before about being houses and you get paid percentage-wise, you come into a bad house. Sometimes if the boys are in a bad mood and you get a bad house, you're not going to have a great match. Because some of them just don't feel like it. Say, why am I going to put out? There's only a couple people. And then you get the other guys that they don't care if there's two people in that mat, in that ring, in the arena. They're still going to put out 100%. So it was always a different chemistry of who was who. And I don't know, the wrestlers back in the day, I don't know, they're just a different kind of person, I guess. I don't know how to explain
it. Well, you know what? I don't think it was necessarily a different kind of person. I think it was a different era. Because it's much like I would draw a parallel between a pro football and pro wrestling. You know, when I watch some of my old-time favorites, you know, your Barry Sanders, your Earl Campbells, people like that, I just think it was a different era of football, you know, with the spread offense and all the throwing these days. You know, today's business is just different. I think everything evolves. Yeah. And I want to evolve this conversation into you throwing me beers. I don't know how many times I've had people ask, hey, man, who was that guy throwing you all those beers? And I always say, hey, it was a timekeeper and former referee Mark Yeaton. And on Twitter, he's at WWE Timekeeper. Mark, here's a question for you, because I don't know the answer. Maybe you can give this to me. But when did we start that? Whose idea was it to start drinking beer? Because I don't remember someone saying, hey, we're going to get Mark to throw you beers. It just happened organically, and we kept doing it.
Yeah, I honestly don't know where it came from, but they tried it one night. It worked, and it just stayed. It stayed for a long time. I just always made sure I had enough beer, because I didn't have beer a couple times, got knocked out for it. So I had to make sure I had enough beer for you.
Hey, Mark, with all the working punches that I hit you with and a couple of stunners, did I ever stiff you, or were you okay? I mean, I'm sure I caught you a time or two.
No, you took care of me every time. You were always very good with me. I guess you knew I was small. I mean, come on, one time after the Montreal situation with Brett, you were mad. I think you were wrestling Mick Foley. And you came to ringside with – you came over and you grabbed the microphone and you grabbed me by my tie and you dragged me in the ring. You cut a promo on me. And a couple of lines I remember is one with put a little bass in your voice trying to piss me off. And another one was, well, you can always get another job. As in, you know, you can't get another life if you screw me. But yeah, but you were always good with me. I never got hurt. I mean, when Paul Bearer had me come into the ring and toll the bell for Undertaker, I got to about three before Kane grabbed me, chokeslammed me, and tombstoned me into the ring. And he was perfect. I mean, it was great. And I mean, Sheamus picks me up by the face, knees me in the gut, throws me across the announce table into the wall. I felt it, of course, but I mean, you guys always took care of me, and I really appreciate that. I still feel stuff from refereeing, but on the overall, there was only a couple of times when I get, like I said, bruised ribs from getting stomped on, a split head from a bell because I pulled it one too many times. But I was really lucky over the years that I didn't get hurt too much.
Hey, going back to the beer throwing, you threw me so many beers, and you had just a hell of a damn touch on that arm, because most of them were like an underhand lob, and, you know, we had signals. I was watching a couple of highlights of us catching beers on YouTube, and I'd give you the kind of the skyhook thing, like I was going to catch it over my head, and you would toss the beer accordingly and pretty much hit the target almost all the time. And it's amazing how many of those beers I caught. And people, I think I did have a pretty good knack for catching beer, but also I had a pretty good quarterback. And so there was a few occasions when you weren't the guy throwing me the beer. Sometimes it was Chimmel, sometimes it was whoever was there, because you weren't at every single show. You were at most of them. And so I was like, where's Eaton? Where's Mark? Because remember a couple of years ago, Terrell Owens was talking about Romo. That's my quarterback. That's my quarterback. Mark Eaton was my quarterback. So if you weren't there, it was just a little off for me, because you were my favorite quarterback to throw those beers. And there was a couple of them, and you'll remember these, where I'd give you the signal, and I'd probably had to been at least 30 yards away, and I'd give you the signal, and you'd kind of give me that like a catcher behind the plate. You kind of give me the no, and I'd like, give me the yes. You're going to throw that beer. And so you kind of like, okay, here goes. And you'd launch about a 30-yarder, and because you was worried about the beer cascading, hitting someone in the head. Do you remember those throws?
Yeah, I remember them, making me throw them over the ring, up the ramp to the stage a couple times. Yeah, you made me throw them quite a distance sometimes. I was always afraid. You were a great catch, so that was always good, but it was always the fear of me getting one of those beers going that distance and going into the crowd and hitting somebody. I'm like, oh, but you never let that happen. Now, like I say, even if you didn't catch it completely, and you still stop it.
I was going to stop it from hitting the fans. Were you in Japan the time we did the beer bash with the Dudleys and Stacy Keibler?
No. Nope. I only went to Japan once. And I don't know if you were there. That was back in days. I don't remember that show too much.
Well, I think we went through 115 beers that night, and that was the most I'd ever went through. Man, I'll tell you what, and a lot of people said, hey, man, was that real beer? And I say, yes, it was always real beer, except for the one time, and there's pictures of it on the internet. We're in, I think it was Molson. Where was the Molson Arena at? It was Montreal.
Yeah, okay.
And so I think it was a Sunday or something like that, whatever it was, but that was, or maybe it was against the rules in the building, but it was NA beer, non-alcohol. And so all of a sudden those pitchers start making rounds and thinking, oh, they're throwing this guy non-alcohol beer. And it's like, no, man. That was a one-time thing, and I don't know why it happened. But all that time I was getting those beers, that was real beer, and people would get mad at me. They'd say, oh, man, you're wasting half the beer by putting it on you. And I would tell the people, it's like, hey, man, the beer that went in my mouth was for me, but the beer that went on me was the show business, and that was for the people. But I can't tell you how many times I left that ring and I had a little bit of a buzz because of all the beers I drank. You know, when you shotgun about, you know, anywhere from 6 to 12 beers, and maybe you get half of them in on an empty stomach after you've wrestled, it goes to your head pretty quick. And there's a couple times when I got to do a little bit of business with Goldberg, and we'd do something after a match. And I'd go out there and I kept tossing Bill beers. And this is back when Bill didn't really drink beer. He had to drink them to keep up his gimmick because Stone Cold's throwing them to him. So, you know, I'd always keep shoveling him beers to get him buzzed. You know, basically, it was a rib.
I don't know how you walk back sometimes with the number of beers you drank that I threw you. I would go through 2-3 cases, and I don't care if you're drinking a third of the can. that's still a lot of beers you were taking. I mean, you'd pour some on some guys and so on and so forth, but you always get a lot of beer in you. I don't think I'd be able to walk out of the ring after that. Never mind up the ramp and backstage.
You know, towards the end, Mark, I always tell people I got paid to drink beer and I wrestled on the side.
There you go.
Hey, Mark, as long as you were on the road with all the Ribbers, the Fugees, the Mr. Perfects, you got any classic rib stories?
I had a few played on me. I know that. I mean, I woke up one time in the locker room with my feet on fire.
What happened?
And I fell asleep, and it was a bad thing. That was back in the Fuji days. I'd wake up on an airplane, and it'd be a glass of water filled to the brim right between my legs. Yeah, there was a few times with me with that, but I can't think of any good classics. There's too many of them, but a lot of them were I can't mention on air.
I know some of them were a little bit perverse, but
a little risque.
In WCW, that some of the ones were a little bit more malicious. Hey, who's beating something in the background?
My wife's cutting up a carrot for the horses.
Oh,
wow, hey. It's picking up that much.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
If we were on an overseas trip, on the UK and Germany trips, if you fell asleep on that bus, you're probably going to lose your eyebrows. And so there's a lot of guys missing eyebrows in that WCW tour. And then was there any of that going on in WWF back in the day?
Oh, yeah. There was some eyebrows missed. There was some smiley faces painted on with Sharpies. There was a ponytail cut off. There's a few of those, yes.
And did you get the padlocks? Because, like, when we would wrestle at some of the armories or some of the high schools, like, you would never think to do this, but the boys would just, if there's a padlock that wasn't secure, you know, this is kind of with the dial-up combination.
But yeah, it ended open, up on somebody's bag.
Oh, it either ended up on somebody's bag or in someone, they'd gather up all your belt loops on your jeans and run that lock through them. So, I mean, when you went to put on your jeans, you couldn't put them on. It's either that or they'd get a leg in your jeans and just put a knot in there and pull your jeans tight. Just one single knot in denim jeans is like a mother to try to untangle. And it's not even it's a half knot, but they would do it so tight that you'd be wearing something else to the next building or to your car to the next town.
Yeah, there were a few like that. And I thinking about it, there was I always did to make sure the locks on the truck were always locked. I didn't want to leave anything hanging around. Yeah, there were a lot of little ones like that. What's his name? Carsten, the German announcer. I mean, they did that to him with his tuxedo. They tied it all up in knots. On the tour bus going to the next town, he woke up in the morning, his tuxedo just in a bunch of knots.
Well, he missed a couple eyebrows too. How did you hear about that story?
Which one?
What was it? Was that in WWF or was that WCW?
That was WWF.
Yeah. I was getting my territories. Okay, I'm getting my territories messed up. Okay, so you were there for that.
Yeah, I was there for that one.
That was a rough ride if you went to sleep. Or maybe you passed out, whatever. Don't close your eyes.
Yep, you definitely don't want to do that. Yeah. There were some bad ones. I know someone that got their they were overseas and they had their whole suitcase, including their passport, put in their bathtub and then the tub filled with water.
Why would they do that to someone's passport?
He said bad things about one of the talent, and no, it shouldn't have been said. And he said it in public. So they said, okay, maybe you'll stay here and take a new passport.
That is called a receipt, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, it is.
That's a stiff receipt, but a receipt nonetheless.
There's other ones about lunches and so on being messed with and so on. But, yeah, there's always a little bit of – I mean, the fun ones are one thing, you know, and then the other ones, like you said, some of them get a little malicious.
I was always down to watch the fun ones. I wasn't a guy that liked to be ribbed, and I didn't rib anybody. I'm good, just, you know, I'm not a rib guy. So I'm not a good participant, so I just rather watch. And thankfully – I don't think I was really ever ribbed. If so, at a very, very minor level, but it wasn't my thing. But Fuji was famous for it, as was Kurt.
Oh.
But Kurt, I mean, you almost couldn't get mad at Kurt because he always had that devilish smile on his face. And it's like, who was that nicknamed him, Dennis the Menace?
Chief J. Strongbow.
Absolutely.
He still had all the nicknames.
He always had a nickname for everybody, and he called him Dennis the Menace. But, you know, when you just see with that smile on his face, he could light up any room he walked into. It was hard to get mad at the guy.
Yeah, that's true. I was at Titan Towers one time, and I'm walking out, and all of a sudden I hear a psss. like, what the hell? I said, what are you doing? I yell across the parking lot in the garage, and all of a sudden Vince stands up from between two cars and says, shh, and puts his finger on his lips. He says, don't say anything. He let the air out of four tires of somebody's car.
Everybody was in on it.
Oh, yes. Everybody had some fun. Hey. Yeah, but like you said, that's not malicious. I mean, yeah, they had to compress it down so they get them filled back up. It's just a little delay. You know, if you slice ties, it's a different story.
Sometimes it was good for morale. Sometimes it pissed guys off. But it was all in the form or vein of entertainment. Owen Hart was another classic rubber.
Oh.
God rest his soul. That, you know, it was on the side of funny. So he pretty much, as you know, he entertained the boys pretty much all trip. If we was on a long loop overseas, morale was down, there was Owen to pick everybody up with his shenanigans.
Oh yeah, his crank phone calls, his pizza deliveries, anything and everything. He was good with that kind of stuff. He always put a smile on people's faces because, like you said, it's a rib, but he made everybody laugh because of it.
Hey, Mark, before you go, got anything coming up you want to talk about? Twitter, you're at WWE Timekeeper. Anything else you want to plug that store you got? And was that in Pennsylvania, Massachusetts?
Yeah. Middletown, Pennsylvania, at Saturday's Market in Middletown. It's called Keeping Time Collectibles. It has its own website. Twitter account, which is Keeping Time Collectibles. And I also have a second Twitter account, Mark Yaton, at Twitter now. Or at Mark Yaton. But now we got a show coming up. Pro Wrestling Empire is coming up, but that's not until February. It's a February show. Eric Bischoff's going to be at that show. With the independent shows around here, they try to bring in celebrities. That's where I get to meet up with the guys again every once in a while. I mean, I saw Billy Gunn a little while ago. The Nasty Boys were coming in next week, I guess, with somebody. I don't know if I'll get to see them, but I've seen Bret Hart a few times, and Ric Flair was there at the last show. So I get to meet up with some of the guys again and get to catch up a little bit.
Man, if the Nasty Boys are coming into town, you better lock everything up.
I warned the guys that hired them. I said, just, you know, they're great, they're fun, but just be careful.
Those guys come in like a hurricane, and just, you get caught up in it. And I talk to Knobs about, I don't know, once every two or three months, and it's the same old Knobs. He hasn't slowed down yet. He's always laughing and joking. I mean, the glass is always half full of that guy, but when he rolls into your territory, be ready.
I'm
be flowing. So what's Eric going to be doing there?
He's actually going to be a special enforcer in the main event for the Pro Wrestling Empire show coming up. Like I said, he's going to kill me because I don't have the date. I think it's February 25th. But yeah, he's going to be the special enforcer. He's doing promo for him. He's going to do a bunch of stuff. He's going to be involved in the show. It's going to be great.
That's good. He gives me a call every time he comes into L.A. Well, not every time, but times when he comes to L.A. and we'll try to get together and go get a bite to eat and have a couple of beers together. You know, people always think there was animosity towards me and him because of when he let me go in WCW, but it's funny to think from the truth because that was the best thing that ever happened to me and I was able to have the career that I had. But yeah, so I'm looking forward to seeing him next time he comes to L.A. And people up there will be able to see the man from WCW live and in living color there in person.
He was a good guy. I worked with him. He did some great characters and stuff when he was with WWE when I was there. It'll be good to see him.
Yeah, I had fun working with him as well as the co-general manager of Raw way back in the day. And why that got cut short, I never really knew. But I guess because we couldn't get on the road and you know, put money into the houses. But nonetheless, it was fun to work with him. Hey, Mark, I appreciate you giving me an hour of your time.
I thought it was fun, Steve. It was great talking to you again. Brings back a lot of fun memories.
Hey, man, it was always fun seeing you at shows. I mean, we hit it off from day one, and you tossed me a bunch of beers, and I appreciate everything. And I'll talk to you again real soon.
All right, you take care of yourself. Thanks for everything.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good night! And welcome to T-Pain's Nappy Boy Radio Podcast, the most fun you'll ever listen to while you're folding your clothes. Now let's get this straight. This is not your average podcast. T-Pain's Nappy Boy Radio is super fun, super crazy. It's pretty much an in-your-face conversation. That's the good thing about us. We don't do interviews. We do conversations. All of my guests, all of my co-hosts, we chill. We drink. We play games. We have the song of the week. We have the creative curse word of the week. As long as you're having fun as our guests. Speaking of guests, each week I'm going to go through my whole contact list and dive headfirst into the world of music, gaming, exotic cars, tech, strippers probably, doctors probably strippers that are only stripping so they can pay for tuition to become a doctor. You never know. My wife is a certified bartender. She'll make you a drink while you're here. We'll get you drunk and make you play VR after. It's a lot going on, but that's what it's all about over here at T-Pain's Nappy Boy Radio Podcast. See you soon, baby!
Yo, what's good? It's your boy, Big Brother Jake, a.k.a. Jake Warner.
My government name.
Check it out. I host a show called the Big Brother Jake Podcast, and I've taken my talents to the biggest and baddest platform on the planet. That's right, baby, Podcast One. My show is unique as I talk about everything. Life, sports, entertainment, being a single dad juggling several jobs. I'm a hot mess, but it's damn entertaining. Subscribe and review now on Apple Podcasts and listen on Podcast One or wherever you get your podcasts.